Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September 14th, 2001. In the fireside room is this afternoon a facilitated conversation about the National Day of Prayer and Remembrance. Let's listen in.
Is there anything we should add to this list? Just how we're going to interact with each other? Then I'll start with a simple prayer. Holy One, we thank you, each one, for the gift of another day, especially a day in this beautiful valley. Each of us has come from different homes, different areas of the country, different life experiences. And yet, for whatever reason, you have guided us each on our path and interwoven us together this week at Holden. We're still in shock over what has happened in our country. We have a flutter of thoughts and feelings. And most of all, God, we just want to lift those thoughts and feelings up to you. And we ask that your light shine around us and into us as we try to discern the meaning of these terrorist attacks on each of us, on our country, on our history and our future. Be with each one of us in this room as we try to speak our thoughts and feelings, incomplete as they are. Help us to be respectful of one another and of each other's life experiences, that through that respect we might learn and share and grow together as we follow your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. I think we're a small enough group that we don't need to go in any sort of order. I'm going to act as facilitator, and I'll just warn you ahead of time that if you talk more than 15 minutes, I'll stop you so that everyone has a chance to speak.
I've been really glad to be at Holden through this. It's been really wonderful to have that sense of community, the chance to gather for prayer together, the chance to bounce some things off of other people, and I think it's helped gain a little more perspective on what's going on. On the one hand, it's odd being so, in a way, isolated. But at the same time, it's been good for me not to be bombarded 24 hours with television, that kind of thing. I can kind of come over and get a little glimpse of the news without, and then go back to some other things, and that's been really, I think, a good thing for me, and I really appreciate the being here.
I have to echo that, because that's been my primary feeling, was how blessed I am to be here and not where televisions are blaring. I'm so glad there is no television set, and that this hyped up emotion from something like this would be blatting all the time, I feel, on my spirit, whereas here at Holden, I can accept the reality without and mull it over a little without having to be bombarded by the news, sensationalized news. I am reminded of, well, the first thing I thought, I wanted to know what the feelings were of whoever it was who started this. So I was glad to see the resource room where we could read what some people were saying. And I read the column on Bin Laden and realized how angry he was and his people were at long time anger against the United States. And I remember when I was in Holden before, we had a wonderful session led by Dr. Norstad. And one of the things I remember from them was that he said, if you meet an angry person, stop and consider what is hurting in that person. Because he says anger is a demonstration of pain and hurt. It's almost a symptom of hurt. And anyone who is angry, who is in fact hurting, and so try to find or realize what is hurting that person. And I think that if I could do that better as I go through my days, but I do forget it sometimes. And it's very easy to feel resentment and revenge and feeling like taking it out on something. And I just remember Dr. Norstad's statement that I must consider what hurt must cause such anger. That's the main thoughts I've had.
Thank you.
I'm concerned when I saw the headline about retaliation. I think that's what's kept the Middle East in turmoil and warfare for so long, is violence and attacks and then retaliation. Both sides do it continually. It feeds on itself. And I'm really hopeful that we won't follow that path, because I don't think there's any solution in that kind of active action.
Fifteen years ago, I was on a cruise with my wife here down the Yangtze River in China. And we got a news bulletin from the BBC that our Air Force had bombed Libya. And that was all we got, was just that statement. And we didn't know what was going to happen or what had happened. But thinking back on that, we bombed Libya because of terrorist activities. We bombed Afghanistan or somewhere where Bin Laden has offices because of another terrorist attack. We demolished the army of Iraq because of their invasion of Iraq. Our response seems to be to try and bomb people in punishment for whatever they do that we don't like. And I agree, that's simply going to escalate the things, right? You could never solve anything by trying to take revenge. It just makes things worse. And I think that's demonstrated by the situation in Bosnia, the situation in the Middle East. We've got to find a better way to seek peaceful means of solving the problem.
I feel the same way about the retaliation issue. And sometimes I almost feel like so many times I've been disappointed by the way that my government, the American government, has handled issues abroad, terrorism, and the injustices that we've caused. And so I always say, well, you know, it's about time something happened to shock us into reevaluating, or our government reevaluating our policies abroad. At the same time, I feel like there's 5,000 people dead. These are my friends and neighbors and classmates, and I feel so guilty for feeling anger against on my own government and just its cause, because so many innocent people lost their lives in this. So it's a big conflict for me, because I feel guilty and unpatriotic for feeling so angry about my own government, you know? And look what,
I've been walking around feeling kind of upset, kind of almost like a headache. And I haven't been reading the papers until today. Just really concerned about what these people, what could cause, you know, somebody to actually want to do this. And I find myself fascinated by, you know, what steps they took, and I don't know, it's you know, I want to be patriotic, and I want to stand up for my country and stuff. Still, you know, I don't know what to feel. I'm just confused about this. You know, the first thought was like, you know, how can this happen? How can, you know, what's going to happen to our world? Is the economy going to, you know, the economy going to get wiped out? Where do we go from here, type thing? I don't know, it's kind of wearing off now once you do it. It's going away. But those people in New York City, it must be really going through a lot, and it's hard not to just push this away and not think about it. So, having a hard time.
I have this sad, sad, sad feeling. And it's this dilemma that has been around forever on what do you do about evil when it appears in the world? And it's, for all we know, it seems to me we have learned nothing on how to deal with it. I read an interesting little article that is painful for me, but it's true, that until this situation happened and was writ large across our country, I was successful in pushing any thoughts of that or concern about it out of my mind completely. But for people who live in Northern Ireland, there are still people that have to worry about whether their husbands or spouses will arrive home at night. It's true in places in the Middle East, it's already been mentioned. It's true in places in Africa. It is present, and we have not learned at all how to deal with it. And have been successful in keeping it out of my mind until something like this happens and it's pushed in your face.
I found myself in a very strange position here, not even wanting to tell people that my background was as a military pilot and as a commercial pilot, because I didn't want to be in the middle of the discussion. I wanted to try to find out where I really was in this. And my feelings are strong for the pilots, for the crew members, for the passengers that were involved in this. And I've honestly struggled with my own feelings on it. What would I have done if I had been there? Would I have released my airplane to someone else? I don't know. I'm sure that they were forced to do that on threat of death to the person that they were standing next to. That they probably came up with a flight attendant and said, get out of your seat or I'll kill this person. And all of our training was simply to follow the directions that they had said, although no one ever discussed leaving the cockpit controls. It was to convince whoever it was that was making the demand that you could take them exactly wherever they wanted to go. And where do I... How do I handle the mixed feeling I have of not being involved in retribution, but in justice? Can we ignore what's happened? I'm sorry that it's an Arabic individual, Arabic individuals who are involved in this. I really am. I hope that we learn something from the Oklahoma bombing, where our first thought was that it was an outsider. But I'm sure many people have not. And it's taken this and it's made them so anti-Arabic that they will lash out at anyone Arabic. And that's what my biggest fear is now.
I wondered what I might bring to this discussion that would be unique because of my background. I happen to have been one of the government that we're talking about here, and had many years of experience in diplomacy and intelligence. And I just want to say a few words to perhaps help all of us understand a little better that this probably is a unique situation if indeed Bin Laden is the perpetrator. And from what I've heard today, the government seems to be willing to tell us that this is indeed almost a certainty. I don't pretend to be an Arabist. I have served in the Middle East, but I have followed the situation, and what I'm about to say, I think you'll probably read in Time magazine when you get back to your homes. Osama bin Laden is a unique person. He was a Saudi, born in Saudi Arabia, a son of very wealthy people. He and his family have their money in oil properties in the oil industry. For reasons I never fully read or understood, he became a bitter enemy of the Saudi royal family sometime in the years immediately preceding the Gulf War. So this would have been sometime in the 80s. He's a man, as I think, roughly in his late 40s, early 50s. He's vigorous, he's healthy. He can certainly afford the best medical care. He's at least a man with hundreds of millions of dollars of personal wealth, perhaps a billion or so, safely squirreled away in Swiss banks where he has easy access to these funds. So he's able to finance virtually whatever he wants to do. People who know this man, who have told us about him, say that he is a man of extremely high ego, a very dedicated man for his own purposes. Now, we understand this in the context of the typical Arab culture, and if you've studied anything about Arab culture, what I say here is not news. But in the traditional Arab tribal societies that go back hundreds of years, in which we still see many remnants today, the concept of the chief or the tribal hierarchy, the power, the pinnacle of authority at the top of this discrete group of people, there may be thousands of people who claim this tribal affiliation, has been very, very important over the last 1,000 years. And this idea of, we would call it machoism perhaps, but it's more than that. It's a matter of extreme personal importance, almost probably at the spiritual level, where the male head of the group is absolutely dominant, and anything that threatens him is a very, very serious personal problem. And you have these historical rivalries between tribal chiefs, and they extend right up to now. Saddam Hussein is a tribal chieftain. Al-Assad of Syria, the same. Some of the chiefs of the sultanates in the Gulf states and the Emirates. What is his name? I can't think of it. The man we're talking about. Thank you. Bin Laden. He's one of these. And unfortunately, as I say, he got into this big beef with the Saudi family, the royal, the kingly line today, and they stripped him of his citizenship and they booted him out of the country. A huge humiliation to this man personally. And remember now, he's a man of extreme personal ego in this Arab culture setting. So he goes, and I should insert before I forget this, he has told close colleagues that his principal long-term aim and dream is to rid the entire Arabian Gulf area of American economic, political, and military influence so that he himself someday may become either the ruler of this entire region or see to it that the rulers of the individual countries are loyal to him. This man is beyond Hitler and his dreams of dominance. That's why I say he's a unique person. And I'm pretty sure this is close to the US official 201 file on this man, if I may say that. So he goes to Afghanistan because nobody else wants him. He's obviously a very dangerous person for Arab governments who don't want this kind of a person to be mucking around in their territory. The Taliban, as you know now, the latest revolutionary government in Afghanistan is a reactionary theocracy which is trying to use the Quran to justify pushing the culture back several centuries, and apparently they're being successful. They've done terrible things in the fields of women's rights and personal punishments for crime and this sort of thing. Now, they apparently are so desperate for financial help that they will accept Bin Laden because he's got a lot of money. So he's out there in the Afghan desert doing his thing, which is to attract people who will do the things that we just saw happen on Tuesday. Imagine a commercial airline pilot, one competent to fly such an aircraft, who is willing to do what four of these people have done, at least, with help. So, as I say, it's a very unique situation, and it has nothing whatever to do with the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. We need to understand that. Bin Laden doesn't care a thing about the Palestinians. Most Arab leaders do not. They see the Palestinian thing as an unfortunate problem, but it's not really germane to them. Most of those Arab leaders have always thought of Palestinians as somewhat beneath them. I use the rather crude example. They look up on them as we use. Some of us used to talk about Okies, for example, during the Depression and this group. So that's kind of where this is, my understanding of it. I hope that we don't think of the Arab reaction is not. As I say, there's a huge caveat here, but assuming that bin Laden is the culprit, then that's the kind of special problem we're dealing with. I think that's enough said.
Excuse me, just one moment, sir. Did you read the story that's in the resource from the Seattle Times, the article on the background of bin Laden?
No, I haven't. I really haven't read very much, to be honest with you.
It says that it dates back further than that. You can read it yourself, but it apparently stems from the Cold War that we were in with Russia, and where bin Laden was helping us, and that at that time he was our friend, but he is a very religious, we might call him a fanatical religious, like some people call the Christian rightist, or some people call Christians that are very conservative and moral majority, or anyway, he's definitely a very religious person, and feels that their sacred land was violated by the king, or by the government leader. And he was angry and argued with the king, and this is what put him in wrong with his own country. And he went, so that's why he's out, because he was protesting the allowing the American planes to come into Saudi Arabia, into holy ground. And I read that as one of the motivations behind. But I look at it also in the light of any tribe or nation that doesn't want their sacred things desolated. The Native Americans are very unhappy with us for taking over the Black Hills and their sacred places. And I think the Arabs probably are like that. And then they want to take our sacred places, and they see the trade towers as our temples. And so that we can look at it kind of that way too. It would be a way. I'm not saying it's the way it is, but it's possible to see it in another way.
I found myself by chance reading the book Shogun at the same point that this all came up. And this fits exactly with people who are so dedicated to a cause that they will do almost anything. It's amazing to me that we look at that in other people and yet don't see that in ourselves. And I'm afraid that as an ex-military man also, that in following the dictates of our own government, we may very well do the same thing that we did in Africa in bombing the chemical factory and find out later that it probably had nothing to do with bin Laden. If bin Laden is the problem here.
I have really conflicting emotions about being up here through all this. I came here because my life is just surrounded with so much stuff that I never have time to stop and reflect and think, and sometimes I think it's because I don't want to stop and reflect and think. Yet I find myself up here at a time that I feel separated from a huge, horrific event and I almost feel a little bit like I'm running away from it again. I couldn't even grasp it until I saw the videos, even though I was reading about it, because I'm a visual person, until I could see it, I couldn't really quite take it in and know what to do with it. And I actually had a terrible time sleeping after watching the video when they finally showed the actual plane going in, because all I could think about were those passengers and what must have been going through their heads as it went in, because they were the least surprised of everybody when this was going on and the trauma. And I find myself up here almost forgetting it's happened, and that bothers me. And so I tell myself I need to kind of keep thinking about it. And I also tell myself it's a blessing to be removed and not barraged and caught up in the moment. But I feel, I don't know, maybe it's guilt or something, but I feel a little bit removed from it. And then I still, even to this day, haven't quite taken it in because I'm so isolated away from it. And I don't know how I feel about that, whether it's good, bad, or neither of the two. But I've been kind of struggling with that being up here.
Well, two ladies spoke at the beginning about the sensationalism of our press and our news media. And I myself, I'm not a technology person. I would love to be able to go back maybe about 30 years. But I just arrived in the village today. And so I was a part of the television. And I guess I would have to say that I was not glued to the television, but that in the days since this event, I found it provided a way for people to begin to move through the grief steps that will need to happen for most citizens, I think. I think the news media, amazingly, have done a coverage that has not really been their typical sensationalism approach. I felt that they were being very sensitive. I think one of the parts that just struck me so specially was, I think it was the Archbishop of California who spoke about an issue that parents were so concerned with. You know, how do we talk with our children about this? You know, it's so difficult for children to have any idea of what this is about. And he encouraged people to gather together in small family groups and light a candle that night and just focus with their children on the fact that, you know, the light of God provides a hope and kind of help them to center in that feeling of connectedness with God. When I left today, it was just the very beginning of the service that was being held in New York City at 12 o'clock. And it was, I think it was a real well done connecting of people in this country. I think there's a connection again, like we probably felt in World War II. It is hard to put a finger on. It's a tying together of us as citizens of the United States. One of the things that just they're starting to do is to have interviews with some of the families that are looking for loved ones. So we've moved through a lot of stages of this, and now we're getting to a really, really human aspect, and that was really difficult. I think it's like, you know, your next door neighbor. and not even beginning to look at all the ramifications that this is going to mean for our country. People are determined that they're going to lift their heads up and move forward, and that this is not going to bring this country to its knees, to war maybe. Well, that's...
I just want to remind not to interrupt, not to correct or speak to, but we're just resting in between each statement and we're speaking for ourselves.
That's okay. But at any rate, I just really have felt that having the news media has been a positive thing, and I would be the last person in the world to normally say that. I think it's really helping people feel not isolated, but a real part of what's going on.
Thank you.
I've had some of the same things that previous speaker mentioned about being at Holden and feeling isolated, and it's like I haven't, even though the newspapers are here, I saw some of the videos, because I'm not out there being bombarded, it's like I've not really been able to accept this yet. It's still almost a dream, like, no, this really didn't happen. I'll go out tomorrow and get back, and I'll see and hear that this really didn't happen. And I'm struggling with, am I glad to be here in this place with this community and being away from the shock of it, or is it delaying my grief process? And on the one hand, I'm glad I'm here, and then I struggle with, gee, it would have been better to be home and have been part of it when it happened and get all the news and maybe some of the bombardment and begin the grieving sooner.
I find that I'm still in the shock place on the grieving. It's like, I don't think it's quite denial, but I feel very removed from it, from this whole atrocity, and that's where I'm at, and that's okay for now, because that's where I'm at. I guess that's all I can say. Yeah, I'm still in shock, and I think I probably will be until I get back. Until I get back and say, I'm not feeling an emotion. Just sort of numb.
On Wednesday, I drove through, I was driving the car the entire day on Tuesday from the moment it happened, listening to the news the entire day. And I think on the next day then was when I finally moved from sort of shock to being very afraid of retaliation and what's going to happen next and kind of disbelief. I talked to my parents on the phone right before coming up here on the boat, and my mother said about regarding the news and media, she said, all the news commentaries were so grave and, serious, and it was kind of nice once in a while you get a commentator who was really angry and really emotional, and she was feeling so much emotion about it, that it was nice to know that there are other people willing to show their emotion on national television. And she was so angry. She's like, well, just bomb the hell out of whoever. It was important for me to like hear that, and then my dad had a completely different perspective. He was more gray area, black. It's more sort of the feelings that I had. It was nice to hear different people's perspective. My parents having realized that those were both valid. then also being scared at the people who really make decisions, you know, our military and our government, and not knowing, you know, if they're going to treat this as a really great issue that takes a lot of delicacy, and I know obviously they will, but, or if it's just going to be this emotion-filled, you know, black and white way of looking at what's just happened. So I feel kind of powerless about the future.
I didn't realize how upset I was and how raw my feelings were until this noon when the hunters popped their guns out of Doc. And I was just very upset. I did not want to see any signs of violence, especially here. It was like, here I'm safe. Here I'm away from the world. I don't want to have to deal with violence. And it was like it was put in my face, and I did not appreciate it. I was writing postcards to people back home, and after I finished it, it seemed that was kind of, it was so trivial, and I couldn't just say, hi, I'm having a wonderful time, it's beautiful here, when all this was going on. So I had to go back and say, pray for peace on each one of them, something that said, you know, I'm aware of what's going on. I'm one with you in the tragedy. And another thing I think is, what would Jesus do? What would his response be? What would he have our response be? I think we have to pray about that and think about that. I also think that it's one of many kind of things that disturb our society, including child abuse and violence against children and the things that we've had to deal with recently, I think, nationwide. And we realize that Jesus' love for one another is not happening. And it's got to start someplace, and probably with us. We have to teach that kind of love to everybody we know.
I was thinking about how different the world is going to be for my grandchildren growing up than it was for me. When I was in college, it was safe to hitchhike as a woman alone. Mm-hmm. And that was a walk. Well, you would not do that now. And my grandchildren are not going to be anywhere near as free.
That was one of my strongest feelings the first day, was grieving the loss of an open society. And a pastor outside of the village, and that has taken me to Israel and Palestine several times for a long period. So I don't know if any of you have ever traveled to Israel, but when you're going in and out of the airports there, you have to go 4 or 5 hours ahead of time, and they hand search every suitcase. They go through everything. And we've been so privileged to live in a secure place, and I assume that more and more restrictions like that will be placed on us. And I also thought a lot about experiences I've had in Palestine, and the last time I was there, which was about a year ago, I was taken on a, I spent time with a United Church of Christ missionary in Bethlehem who works with the Palestinian refugees who have been in these refugee camps since 1948 with no sewer, no paved roads, no ability to work. And literally next, it's like the third world and the first world are right there. They have TVs, they can see the wealth, and that's right across the street in some cases in Israel. And it's just, that's just, I don't know, it's just part of the, I spent time in a community center there with children who were so excited to show their little arts and crafts projects to me as a visitor from America. And I mean, that's part of this tension. And then on the other hand is, it seems to me that, well, I'm personally, I don't find easy answers. I mean, this is a criminal act, and the we have members of our long-term staff who have a family member who works in an insurance company in the towers, and they went out yesterday hoping to get news, and he's probably dead, and he works in this insurance company. His job is to investigate factories to make sure that that the laws protecting, the safety laws protecting labor in factories are being followed. You know, he's not a cruel capitalist. He's a person with, he's the brother of someone who works here. He has two children in grade school. And I appreciated you speaking as a pilot, and I think the closer we come to the personal is the better, but helps us feel what's going on, but also that the Palestinians are people. And and Bin Laden, if it is his organization, is is certainly a sinister hero, and probably isn't doing it on their behalf. But there's something horrible about just all of these tensions and paradoxes and pain we live in. And I heard someone say, well, it's too bad that those people were killed in New York, but after all, America deserves it. And I tried to think of someone coming here to Holden and killing the children over at Narnia and being able to say that. When our political dogmas make us that insensitive, I don't know. I'm just still in a state of total confusion. All these contradictory thoughts that you're saying just right within myself.
I have been using my shortwave radio to try to find VOA at various times of the day and night, since it's pretty hard to get medium wave. And last night I happened on a Radio Havana newscast, a woman speaking English. I think they're aiming this broadcast mainly at the Florida Hispanic community. But she rattled off a number of news dispatches and commentaries from America's traditional enemies. You can fill out the list yourself from around the world, pointing out that, yeah, the Americans sort of have this coming to them because of all the bad things they've done in the region. I think it's going to be very difficult for our own leaders to separate the Palestinian-Israeli conflict from this thing that happened on Tuesday night. As I said earlier, I hope we can see that they're only very tangentially related to each other in terms of, again, if Bin Laden is the guy. But I think that's something we need to think about and be very careful that we don't confuse our thinking by linking these two things together.
We have just a couple more minutes. Is there anyone who has not spoken yet who would like to?
I'm up here at Holden by myself without my family or close friends. And I think what I find the most difficult is that isolation from those people, not being able to even call them here to find out how they are. And that's just very painful for me, to be that separated from the people that mean the most to me, even though they're here on the West Coast and not involved in the direct hit. But it's the just not being able to communicate with them is very, very difficult.
I agree with Mary Jo. I'm from New Jersey and have two daughters who work in the DC area. One daughter who works right next to the Pentagon, and it was quite disturbing to hear that news. However, my husband saw fit to be very smart and send me a fax, which assured me that she was fine. She had never had to go into work that morning, that she was called before she went in. And my other daughter, who lives in Annapolis but works in D.C., had gotten into work but turned right around and went back home again, gathered her whole family together, and was home for the day. But that's what I felt, Margaret, about being here, was not being with my family and not knowing. Knowing initially that they're okay, but not knowing whether my daughter has had to go into work since, has she had to go into work next to a disaster area? You know, what has this meant to them? You know, I don't know. I don't know how they're feeling. I don't know what's happening to them. And I'm ready to go home and find out and be with them.
I don't sense that we feel it here. But I think we all have to be prepared as we go home to know that we will have close friends who will be very angry. Mm-hmm. And that's a part of the process that they're dealing with, especially if they have friends or family involved in this.
And that's when we must listen to them.
Yes.
That's what the person who said that to you, that we deserve it, in a different connotation. It isn't deserving, but we Americans have not listened, perhaps, to the cries. We have a granddaughter who has worked with the protests against the W2, the World Trade Organization, and I wasn't in favor of it at first because I thought a world organization was good. But she has studied more than I have of the third world and the sustainable development, and sees a lot more than I do about the situation in the world with the people who have nothing, no food and no jobs and no clothes, and in what ways this is exploiting them. And I don't see that, but her feeling is that the United States does not listen. And they went on this protest to insist in Seattle that they be listened to. Now, of course, the anarchists and the various others made a riot out of it, but still the United States, I do think, is guilty of not listening to the third world voices that are calling to us. And we need to listen to people who are angry.
We're out of time. Let's just take a moment to be silent together and let all that's been said settle into our hearts. There's so much that we don't understand. We're still in the process of receiving what has happened. We thank you for this time to share some of our thoughts and feelings. We thank you for those things that bind us together and allow us to be together in community, even at a time like this. We lift up all the questions we have as an offering to you. We lift up all those who've been personally touched by this tragedy. We lift up that bigger picture about our relationship to third world people and questions of justice and peace. We remember that your word shalom does not mean just peace, but peace with justice. And even in our confusion, we ask you to lead us day by day, whether we're staying here or going home, to be instruments of that peace with justice, that a new world might indeed be born through us. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.